Well, welcome. good afternoon. I'm Rick Barton, co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project with Karen Von Hippel here at CSIS, and on behalf of John Hamry, our president, Steve Flanagan, the head of the International Security Program. It's great to have you all here today. We're pleased to have this program. We've been doing quite a lot of work, as you know, over the last several years on Afghanistan. We have a report coming out on Pakistan in the next day or so. At least our draft report should be on the street tomorrow. It's called A Perilous Course, and we hope that many of you will be getting that. I'm not sure if we've had a sign-up sheet or not, but if we haven't, maybe Shannon or Pete could send around a sign-up sheet of some kind, so people want to receive it. You can certainly get that. As you know, we had a report called Breaking Point that measured progress in Afghanistan that came out a few months ago, and it was really as a result of that work that we came into contact with Ambassador Tom Schweik, who we're very pleased to have here today. As many of you know, he is the acting Assistant Secretary now for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, and has really worked on this most challenging issue, one that's really critical to the future of Afghanistan, obviously other parts of the world as well, but clearly featured in Afghanistan. What we're hoping to do in this conversation is that the ambassador will speak for about 15 minutes or so, and then we'll just open it up to a discussion with all of you. So there should be plenty of time for anybody who still would like to sit down. You don't have to be at the head table. We can push these chairs around, and you can be on the side. There's no reason to stand. So please come forward. We don't call people from the front to the back necessarily. Not too much exposure. But it is a tough and complicated job that he has. I think he's going to give us a good description of how the State Department and the U.S. government are trying to tackle it. And then we look forward to your questions. And the only thing I'll ask is when you do, we get to the question and answer period, please just identify yourself and where you're from, and then we'll take it from there. So, Tom, good to have you here, and it's all yours.
Thanks, Rick, and thanks, everybody, for coming. Originally, when we agreed to do this program, which was about 6 or 7 weeks ago, I had told Rick that the U.S. interagency, I was leading a team to try to develop a new implementation strategy for counter-narcotics in Afghanistan, and I said we'll be probably releasing it a week or two before I come here, and then I'll just sort of answer questions about the rollout and any issues you might have. But y'all are lucky because we ended up, because of a principals conflict, delaying the approval of the strategy, which has now been fully approved, and it won't actually be rolled out until next Tuesday in a media event that will be led by John Walters, and I'll be giving a briefing. So you'll actually are getting a preview of what's about to come rather than a postmortem on what we've just done. And so I'd be real interested in your reaction to what we're proposing to do with the new approach we're going to take to narcotics in Afghanistan. And I'm pleased to make really the first – have the first real discussion about it today. Obviously, we'll save something for Tuesday, but at least you'll get a flavor of what we're going to be doing. We all know, everybody in the room, I see a lot of familiar faces, what a huge problem we have with opium coming out of Afghanistan. We sometimes think of it pretty much as a drug problem, and it is a huge drug problem. Right now, we anticipate that when the September statistics come out from the United Nations, you'll see a situation where Afghanistan is providing close to 95% of the world's heroin. That makes it almost a sole source supplier. One of the only exceptions is the United States, which still gets most of its heroin from South America. But you'll see a situation really unique in world history where almost all of one very serious drug is coming from one country. And so we view it as a major public health problem for Europe, for the Soviet Union or the former republics of the Soviet Union and Russia. In Afghanistan, there's a rising drug addiction rate. We speak regularly with our colleagues from Pakistan, and obviously there's a major drug transit problem and therefore a drug use problem there. Iran, while the U.S. doesn't have direct discussions with Iran about drugs, we know it now has the highest opium or heroin addiction rate in the world, a very serious problem, which they acknowledge fairly openly in international fora. There's rumblings of it moving now into China, and there are transit points now through Africa. So it's becoming a worldwide epidemic, both in terms of transit, in terms of addiction, in terms of the crime and corruption it fosters around the world. It is a huge drug problem. But it's a lot more than a drug problem, as we all know. Everyone has a vested interest, everyone in this world, in seeing the Afghan people build a stable state, a stable democracy where its people, after 30 years of war and strife, can live in peace. And the drug problem not only is a drug problem, but it threatens the very existence of the Afghan state. It's an economic problem. We have a situation now where the drug economy is 25% to 33% of the entire Afghan economy, depending on which statistics you put your faith in, but we all know it's a big percentage. And not only that, but even in the illicit economy now, we're seeing what we've seen in Colombia for a long time, which is front companies, money laundering, situations where even the illicit economy is now being polluted by the drug economy. So everything we're trying to do in terms of reconstruction and building a stable economy in Afghanistan is also threatened by the drug trade. So it's a drug problem, but it's also a serious economic challenge for the people of Afghanistan. It's a political problem. Whenever there is this much money available this cheaply and this quickly and this easily as you have with this flourishing drug trade in Afghanistan, it will start to corrupt the political system. And we already know now there are documented cases of governors of large provinces of Afghanistan being heavily involved in the drug trade. We know police chiefs, deputy police chiefs, district governors, even some senior officials in Kabul are likely involved in the trade. And therefore, the development of the Afghan government, both at a federal level and at a provincial level, is now threatened also by the opium trade. So it's a drug problem, it's an economic problem, and it's a political problem. And as I mentioned earlier, it's a regional problem since all of its neighbors are now experiencing major drug addiction rates and transit through their countries, which threatens their law enforcement capacity. More recently, we've noticed that it's also an insurgency problem and a security problem. I would say when I started at INL, the Bureau for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs at the State Department a year and a half ago, we had some anecdotal evidence that the Taliban was sometimes taxing farmers or opium traffickers or contributing to the transit on an opportunistic basis. There were certain relationships between terrorism, insurgency, Taliban, and the drug trade, but they were not sophisticated and they were not well-developed, and there were varying theories on how sophisticated and how well-developed they would become. Well, there's no theories anymore. Everybody's in agreement now. The alarming amount of intelligence coming out that the Taliban is becoming much more structured in its attempt to tax and profit from the trade. You have amazing evidence coming out of specific direction being given by Taliban commanders to locate this particular narco trafficker and extract this amount of money. And it's a two-way street. The narco traffickers are offering, you know, IEDs and other things in exchange for protection from insurgents. So it's nothing like Colombia yet. It's nothing like we have with the FARC, where they literally are basically a drug enterprise from top to bottom. But we think it's moving in that direction, and absent more aggressive activity on the part of the Afghan government and the international community, including the United States, we risk a much more sophisticated relationship developing between the insurgent and terrorist forces and the narco trade. I mean, the money's too easy. As we know, opium keeps for years. It's a good form of currency. It's very valuable. And even though the Taliban put a ban on opium for 1 year during the very end of its reign, it now realizes that you can't ignore that source of income and is more and more relying upon it. So now the very fight we're in, the war that we're in, is threatened also by the opium trade. So you have a really catastrophic, potentially catastrophic problem in the sense that it cuts across all things we're trying to do there. It's a drug and health problem. It's an economic problem. It's a regional cooperation problem. It's a political problem. It's a terrorism problem. It is something we have to be more aggressive in attacking and make a very top priority, and that's what we're doing. I want to talk a little bit about the current trends in Afghanistan before I go into what we plan to do about it. In the past, the opium trade in the past 3 or 4 years has been distributed across all geographic areas of the country. Nangarhar, a very high-producing province until a couple of years ago. Badakhshan and Balkh in the north, high-producing provinces. Badghis and Herat, relatively high-producing provinces over in the west. And, of course, Helmand and Kandahar, very, very high-producing provinces in the south. And Uruzgan and Dainkondi in the middle, also very high-producing provinces. So the strategy that was adopted by the Afghan government and the international community was sort of a national strategy. And they have a national drugs control strategy, which is a very comprehensive document which lays out how the government of Afghanistan plans to combat this. As we were studying, as I was tasked to put together an interagency group about 4 months ago to study how to attack this growing problem, we also consulted extensively with our colleagues in the United Nations, our UK colleagues who are the lead nation in counter-narcotics. And as we studied this, we noted some regional trends which are visible on the map that you see in front of you, which is a UN map. For the first time ever, we actually see a pretty steady decline in opium production in the north of the country, with a possible exception of Nangarhar, and a massive increase in the south. It's becoming more regionalized than it was before. You're seeing, for example, we have good information that Balkh, if you look up in the center, which shows 7,200 hectares under cultivation last year, is almost poppy-free this year, a dramatic and significant reduction. And in other northern provinces like Badakhshan and Saripol and others, we're seeing significant dramatic drops in poppy production. And instead, the production is focusing on three provinces. In fact, we estimate, and this is just an estimate, I'll leave it to the UN to give the final numbers, but we estimate that if you take Helmand province and Uruzgan in the south and Nangarhar, they will account for 80% of the opium production this year. So it used to be sort of a countrywide problem distributed across many provinces. Now we're seeing a sharp trend toward three or so provinces, with Kandahar slightly behind those. And so our strategy now can't be a national strategy. It can't be one that's applies across all provinces. It has to be more sophisticated. It has to account for the differences in the north and the south, and it has to account for the massive growth in three provinces. And basically, as we looked into this, what our objective was to consolidate the gains and the trends we're seeing in most of the provinces, increase the number of poppy-free provinces dramatically, get those that are moving in that direction to accelerate their move toward poppy-free status, and then develop very special and unique strategies for those provinces that are demonstrating increases and where we don't see any capacity right now to control it. As I mentioned, back in January or February, the cabinet secretaries were briefed on this issue. They tasked a group led by John Walters, the drug czar, and John Negroponte, the deputy secretary of state, to look at the implementation strategy in light of these trends and to develop some new ideas on how we might be able to combat the traffic, recognizing these regional differences and these province-by-province differences. I led an interagency group, mostly the deputy assistant secretary level, that consisted of the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Department of State, the Department of Defense, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Department of Justice, the Department of the Treasury, and others, NSC and ONDCP among them, where we literally met around a table like this and said, okay, here's the problem. What are we going to do to refine and improve our implementation of our strategy to combat this? And what I thought I would do is, without taking away from the big announcement that we're going to have next Tuesday, is give you sort of a preview of how we view the problem and the types of things we think are necessary in order to combat the problem. And I'll just cover it in order. You may know that 2 years ago, the U.S. Adopted a five-pillar strategy for combating narcotics in Afghanistan, which is very much based on the eight-pillar strategy the Afghan government has. We actually work on all eight, but we focus on five. It is, first, public information. We recognize that getting the right messaging out to the Afghan people is critical, especially since the Taliban is very, very good at its information strategy, so it's very important to have a counter strategy to that. And even though it sounds just like we're talking about advertisements and discussion, I don't think we can underestimate the importance of information in Afghanistan, good and accurate information, since there is so much misinformation going on there. So we consider public information a critical part of the strategy. The second piece is alternative development. You can't expect a farmer to switch away from poppy unless you offer something viable to grow in return. And alternative development efforts are led by AID. Other agencies contribute to some extent, and that remains a critical pillar to make sure that farmers have something else that they can grow. But as we discuss this issue, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the changes we'll make there, we discussed the soft side, which is alternative development, but we also talked about the hard side, which is eradication, interdiction, and prosecution, which are the last three parts of the pillar. Are those working? Is that effective? There's a tremendous controversy surrounding eradication, particularly spray eradication, and there were hours and hours of discussion about that issue. Eradication, and I'll go back through all these in a minute and tell you what we're going to do about it. But eradication, it was determined, is an essential part of any strategy. There is no example we're aware of in the world of a situation where a country was able to eliminate its opium production without that threat, because there's simply nothing anybody can offer that equals the income of opium. And I'll get to that in a minute in a little more detail. So eradication is part of the strategy. Interdiction, obviously, if you're going to go after farmers who are growing poppy, you have to go after those who are trafficking. That's where most of the money is, although a lot does go to the farmers. Most of it goes to the traffickers. There has to be a good and coherent strategy to disrupt the trade, close the opium bazaars, and arrest the kingpins, which is a critical part of any strategy anywhere in eliminating a drug problem. And finally, prosecution. Once you have interdicted and arrested, you have to have a court system, a viable system of justice that permits the incarceration of the people who are guilty, or the extradition of those people to countries that wish to try them in their country. So we looked at all five pillars. The general conclusion was that the overarching five pillars are correct, that those are the five things you need to do in order to eliminate an opium trade. But obviously, with an expected increase again this year, that there needs to be some refinement or improvement, because we're not seeing nationwide reductions in poppy production or heroin production, as I said, which is probably going to go up again when we get the numbers this year. So what I thought I would do is go through, in very general terms, because the paper hasn't been released yet, what the approach will be going forward with the United States. We have discussed this extensively with the UK, our counterparts, and it's been discussed in Kabul with the government of Afghanistan about how we propose to proceed. In terms of public information, the general perception of our group was that we have made some improvements in the North by moving somewhat away from traditional methods of disseminating information, which would be radio advertisements, posters, billboards, those kind of things, which you see all around Afghanistan when you go around the countryside. And they're still valuable in getting the message across. But the way things work in Afghanistan is more by word of mouth, by winning over religious leaders, shuras, tribal elders, that kind of a thing. And this was attempted in Balkh province extensively over the past year, and the governor was very, very pleased with that by working it on a village-by-village, tribe-by-tribe basis. Similarly, in Nangarhar a couple of years ago, that's a lot of what was done, was working it with the shuras. And I think, to be general, the perception was that public information should shift away from more traditional means of advertising, for lack of a better phrase, and more toward word of mouth and community outreach on a local basis. And you'll see proposals in our new strategy to improve the capacity to reach people on an individual basis and move away from more general advertising techniques. The other aspect of public information that was lacking was there was not an effective level of coordination between the counterinsurgency campaign being prosecuted by ISAF and the counter-narcotics campaign being prosecuted by the government of Afghanistan. And you will see in this upcoming document specific proposals to have a much more integrated public information campaign that recognizes that there is a direct relationship between narcotics and insurgency, and therefore the messaging has to be consistent and firm. And so we will be making refinements there, and as I said, we'll roll that out next Tuesday. But you'll see refinements in both of those areas to the public information campaign. The second thing is alternative development. There is a widespread perception that farmers who are growing poppy have not been offered an alternative. And that's perpetuated by some of the groups that want to legalize drugs. It's perpetuated by some of the corrupt officials. It's perpetuated by some that that just simply haven't studied the issue that well. It is true that there are large parts of Afghanistan where farmers don't have a viable alternative. We've studied this with our UK partners. There's been tremendous amount of satellite imagery, on-the-ground work done by people like David Mansfield and others. We estimate that the number of farmers, poppy farmers in Afghanistan that don't have an alternative is between 30% and 40%. But that also means that between 60% and 70% do have an alternative. Let's take Helmand Province, for example. Helmand Province, this year we estimate will have more than 50% of the entire Afghan poppy crop. It is one of the wealthiest provinces in Afghanistan. If it were a country, it would be the fifth largest recipient of U.S. aid of any country on earth. Hundreds of millions of dollars of development assistance going into Helmand Province. More interestingly, the central districts of Helmand, which is where most of the poppy is grown, are the richest parts of a relatively wealthy province. The irrigation and infrastructure for farming that is there was actually put in by the United States of America about 50 years ago, and it's still working and it's still functioning very well. Access to markets is good. Alternatives are available. And you know, 75% of the cultivation in Helmand Province is new in the past 2 years. So it is impossible to legitimately make the argument these are poor farmers that have been doing this for generation after generation after generation. They weren't doing it 2 years ago, so they certainly weren't doing it for generation after generation. What we find in Helmand Province is that most of the people growing poppy, and not all but most, are wealthy landowners, corrupt officials, and opportunists who see a security vacuum and who have turned down the alternative that was offered to them in favor of growing a much higher yield, much higher profit crop. So while we do discuss in the paper extensive means to improve the delivery of alternative development through better access to markets where markets aren't there, through use of private organizations as agents to sell crops at higher prices in Dubai and Islamabad, there are a lot of real good suggestions in the paper for how to improve the delivery of alternative development, how to get closer to the income from poppy by offering alternatives. It is a fact, and it's a fact that we can't shy away from and we can't allow ourselves to be misinformed about, that in a large percentage of the cases, the farmers in these areas have turned down the alternative and they need to be dealt with in a more severe way. It sounds tough to say that. It's an unpopular thing to say, but I think it's the facts. We looked at this very carefully. We studied targeting data. We studied on the ground surveys that have been done. And for a significant percentage of poppy farmers in Afghanistan, there needs to be a coercive element. And that's something we're not going to back away from or shy away from. In those areas where they don't have alternatives, we have no right to eradicate. But in those areas where these people have an alternative, where there's access to markets, where there's relative wealth, that's where the eradication policy comes in. And, you know, we had our AID colleagues sitting at the table with us, and they said the same thing. They said we constantly get blamed for not offering alternatives. Well, a lot of these cases we have offered alternatives, and they're not taking them. And that's where the eradication policy comes in. And we think it is an essential policy. If you look at Thailand or Pakistan or Laos or places that have had successful anti-narcotics, anti-poppy efforts, there's always been that element of risk. Because if you tell a farmer that you have no risk of losing your crop, they're always going to go with the more valuable crop, which is poppy. And in some cases, there's some fruit trees and things over years can maybe get 50 or 60% of the income from poppy, but we have never found a crop that can actually replace dollar for dollar the income you get growing poppy. And therefore, there has to be a credible threat of eradication. I've consulted very closely with the United Nations on this question. Antonio Costa and I met for 3 hours on Tuesday in Vienna earlier this week to discuss this issue. The general belief on the part of the experts that have studied this for a long time is that in order to introduce an element of risk to the farmer such that the farmer will not plant poppy the next year, you need to eradicate about 25% of the crop in a given area or district. When they see they got a 1 in 4 chance of losing everything, they'll start thinking about taking the alternative that was developed. At the same time, you also have to offer them credit the way the Taliban does and other things so that they don't go into debt too much. We recognize there are other pieces that have to be in place. But we do believe, and it was widely confirmed throughout the interagency, that a tough eradication policy in areas where alternatives are available is an essential strategy, and we actually have to improve that. The past year, eradication in raw numbers improved from 15,000 hectares nationwide to about 20,000 hectares. But that doesn't tell a proper story. First of all, it's only about 10 or 11% of the total crop. So it's nowhere near the level we need to deter planting. And second of all, it was not equitable eradication. And one thing that I think was brought up in your study, which we agree with entirely, is that if you're going to eradicate, you have to eradicate equitably. And what you're finding is when you go on the ground with a manual-based eradication team that has no force protection, what you find is that it's a negotiation. You send your eradication team out there, the governor has his team, or there's the central eradication force, and they get stopped by a group of elders, and they say, okay, excuse me, what are you about to do? Well, we're going to eradicate. Well, we need to negotiate with you where you're going to eradicate. Well, we have no capacity to say, no, we're going to eradicate where we want to. So they say, you know, you can go in this field here and that one there and that one there, but you got to stay away from these four over here. And what happens is something we don't want to happen, which is inequitable eradication. They do steer you to the least powerful and the least wealthy and the ones who are least able to pay bribes and the ones who are least able to protect themselves. So you do find a situation where the eradication is not fair. The wealthiest people get off the hook, and the less wealthy people get eradicated. That's something we address in this paper, and we have some very specific suggestions on how to avoid that in the future. You cannot have a situation, if eradication is your policy, where the most powerful people are not eradicated and the least powerful are. We recognize that's been a problem, and we're working on means, and we'll discuss those more on Tuesday about how to prevent that, although I'm happy to discuss it in the question and answer period to some extent. So we continue to believe eradication is essential. We think we need to eradicate more. We need to be more careful in our targeting about where we eradicate to avoid eradicating poor farmers who have no alternatives, and we need to avoid inequitable and negotiated eradication where people tell us where we want to go, where we should go, rather than we go where we know we should be. And that's another thing we've been discussing extensively with our UK partners and with the United Nations, the essential aspect there. Okay, interdiction. That's another critical piece. And it's probably the piece where you will see U.S. funding increase by the most. We recognize that there has not been enough interdiction. In Colombia, approximately one quarter of the entire cocaine production capacity in one form or another, whether it's the coca leaf or the paste or the actual cocaine, is interdicted inside Colombia. So you have a strong interdiction capability. Any narco trafficker in Colombia knows that he or she has a pretty good chance of being nailed even before they leave the country. And another 25% is interdicted outside the country. In Afghanistan, you have a total of about, we believe, 24% of all Afghan opium is interdicted somewhere, but only 2% or less in Afghanistan. So the capacity within Afghanistan to stop the trade is almost non-existent right now, and it needs to be built up rapidly, and a lot of resources need to be brought to bear to do that. Why do we have this problem? Well, first of all, interdiction is very difficult. Eradication is simple. You see this big open poppy field. You can fly in a helicopter across Afghanistan and spot the poppy fields at any stage, cabbage on up. When they're blooming, it's really obvious, it's a big red field. But even before then, you can see the fields. You can't move the field. You can't hide the field. It's easy to see where you're going to eradicate. Interdiction is much, much more difficult. Opium can store for 3 or 4 years easily. It can be moved through any means of transportation. It can be moved over mountains, on roads, around border posts, and through border posts. It's very, very easy. So interdiction is always, by definition, more difficult, requires a much more sophisticated technical capability, and that's been lacking in Afghanistan. You have the counter-narcotics police of Afghanistan, which is authorized at up to, I think, 2,900. It only has 1,400 trained people right now. For an entire country of 30 or 40 million people, to have only 1,400 people who are totally dedicated, simply not enough. So we're busily trying to train the counter-narcotics police of Afghanistan. The recruits are fairly raw. There's a lot of education that needs to occur. And the tools need to be there. Once you have trained police that can go in and conduct takedown operations, you need to get them to where the narco traffickers are. And needless to say, they don't live on Main Street. They live in remote areas, difficult areas to get to, and they are protected, very well protected, by local populations that they pay off and by their own little militias that they have. So you have to have a capacity to airlift police through helicopters or other means to get an element of surprise to take down these high-level traffickers. And then you have to have the capacity to gather evidence, which is very, very difficult. What we hear is, well, this person's involved in the trade, but the intelligence tends to be human intelligence. Somebody's saying that somebody's involved in the trade. Well, that doesn't stand up in court. Afghanistan is a democracy. You need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody is guilty. And so you have to get better evidence. You have to have forensic evidence, controlled deliveries, intercepts, or some way to prove that this individual who is alleged to be involved in the narcotics trade is in fact involved. So there's a huge challenge ahead to get appropriate interdiction and arrest capability for senior narco traffickers. You can't just rely on word of mouth or somebody's statement that somebody's involved. You've got to have the element of surprise. You've got to be able to get to that person. Then you have to be able to gather evidence that's sufficient to obtain a conviction in a court of law, which is very, very difficult. But you'll see in the paper when it's rolled out Tuesday a lot of specific suggestions on how we plan to improve our training, the speed of our training, the capacity for interdiction operations to occur, the training and equipping of the counter-narcotics police of Afghanistan, the ability to go in with a force protection capability so they don't have to worry about being ambushed or stopped when they do it, and the capacity to introduce evidence at trial. And that leads to the last pillar, which is prosecution. Even if you've gathered evidence and have built a good case, if there is a corrupt or ineffective or non-functioning judicial system, you can't try or incarcerate the person. And there have been cases, and everyone knows it, where somebody got arrested, there was a good case against them, and the next day they disappeared from jail, and there was nowhere to go. In order to address this, President Karzai authorized the formation of the Criminal Justice Task Force a couple of years ago. That is a central court with vetted investigators, judges, and prosecutors, highly trained and vetted, that have exclusive jurisdiction for all narcotics cases involving 3 kilograms or more at anywhere in the country. And this isn't something we wanted to do. Obviously, you want a nationwide justice system if you can have it. But the problem is so severe And it's getting so much worse that the perception was we can't wait for the provinces and for the entire country of Afghanistan to have a serviceable judicial system to prosecute narcotics cases. So there's this court of exclusive jurisdiction, which originally was controversial in the international community but really isn't anymore. Everyone recognizes it's necessary, at least for the time being, to have this. The problem was it's relatively small, and it focused on small and mid-level traffickers. We're training people, and you'll see proposals in the strategy to train people more effectively going forward to be able to handle larger cases. And then there has to be a corrections capability. We're increasing our corrections support so people can be incarcerated and not have the opportunity to bribe their way out of jail or escape if there's inadequate security. We also think there needs to be an expansion and not focus just on narcotics cases, but also narcotics-related corruption cases. So where a public official might not be directly involved in the trade but facilitating it or taking bribes, we want to expand the capability of that task force to try those cases as well and include that within their jurisdiction. So that's another major initiative, which is to vastly expand the capability to prosecute and incarcerate narco traffickers and corrupt officials who are involved in narcotics trafficking. So that covers, in a nutshell, the five main pillars and some of the improvements that we're going to make. And again, I've been warned not to give all the details out today, so we have a good event on Tuesday where we really roll out the specifics. But we will be addressing all of those issues in quite a bit of detail. The document's 90 or 95 pages long and covers all these issues in a great amount of detail about what needs to be done. But we added a couple of sections to the report. We didn't just focus on the five main pillars. There are a couple of other issues that are addressed in a great amount of detail in the report. One is political will. One of the reasons why you see bulk going down to almost 0 hectares this year is because the governor decided, for whatever reason, I'm going to get rid of poppy. And that's a pretty cheap commodity. If the governor of the province really wants to get rid of poppy and there's relative security like there is in the north, it can be done. And we think there need to be rewards for those who are successful and serious consequences for those who are unsuccessful in the situation of political leaders, not just at the governor level, but the district governors and police chiefs. And we will be offering a vast new set of incentives for those who are successful. It will be a very comprehensive program. We'll give a preview of it next Tuesday, and then President Karzai himself will announce it later on, the specifics of this program. There has not been enough reward to those who are successful, and you will see significant amounts of additional development assistance going to those officials with the proper controls in place, obviously, who are successful. And that's going to be one of the major new initiatives we roll out, which is we're going to put a lot of money and effort and time into rewarding those who are successful. There have to be incentives along with disincentives, and we will have a very large new program of incentives to encourage political will. But we will also expect to see those who are unsuccessful suffer consequences as well, and that will also be addressed in the paper. The next thing is closer coordination between counterinsurgency and counter-narcotics. I mentioned it in the context of my discussion a couple of minutes ago about the information campaign, but it needs to be also extended to operations. There need to be – ISAF has very strict rules against not participating in eradication or interdiction operations directly, but they are allowed to provide intelligence and other support to those efforts. And we're looking to have a much more coordinated and formal relationship with ISAF whereby there is ISAF support for counter-narcotics operations within the scope of their operations plan. There's no suggestion that plan has to be changed. Everything that needs to be done is in it, but there has not been adequate coordination, and the paper makes significant suggestions on how that can be improved. We have to recognize that counter-narcotics and counterinsurgency are basically the same thing now, and I think that's what we're proposing as we go forward. Finally, I wanted to address what we call silver bullet theories. We looked into a lot of ideas that people have given us, and we take everything very seriously. There's, I think, sort of a perception that this administration, you know, is out to just eradicate crops and break down labs, and is not looking at the broader picture and considering more what I call soft options or more revolutionary options. We have looked at everything. We have studied everything, and we've considered everything very carefully. And what I just outlined to you is the plan we think that will actually work. But we did consider some other things that we think deflect attention from a more comprehensive plan. The first one is the legalization or the buyout argument. We put large amounts of resources into analyzing this issue. We actually have now already pre-posted a lengthy discussion of the Senless Council's proposals on our website. And you know, it sounds good on the surface. Look, you've got this huge burgeoning out-of-control problem. You've got a police that's not capable of controlling it at this time. And, you know, and then there's some misinformation spread about you don't want to eradicate poor farmers, which, as I said, we don't do. But it makes the idea of just legalizing it and buying it out a very appealing one. And as a litigator, before I came to this job, I always thought the person that has the easier argument usually wins. And this one sounds so nice. You know, just look, you've got AIDS in Africa, and you've got all these problems around the world with people who need painkillers, and you've got all this opium. Well, let's put them together, and you know, we got a solution. And it does sound nice on the surface, but we analyzed it very, very carefully. And let me tell you what our conclusions were about the idea of buying out the crop or legalizing it. Right now, the price for legal opium is about $50, I think, per kilo, something like that. And the illegal opium price ranges from $150 down to $110. The prices have dropped a little bit because of the massive supply. But the bottom line is it's at least twice as lucrative to grow illegal opium as legal opium, and sometimes in some areas three times as lucrative. So the first point I make is, why would a farmer switch to illegal opium when they can only get a half to a third of what they can get for illegal opium? There's no reason. This is the same farmer that rejected the illicit crops we've offered, which also provide them about the same amount of money per hectare. So what would be the reason? They've already rejected fruit trees. They've rejected cotton. They've rejected all the other things that AID has offered them that can give them about the same price as legal opium. So what would possibly be the incentive to switch? There is none. So that's the first huge problem with the legalization argument, is there's no incentive to switch. If you read the footnotes and the fine print in the literature of the people who have been advocating buyouts, they acknowledge this fact. And they say what you'd have to do is you'd have to have a subsidy to make up the difference. It's right there in the literature. I can point you to the page. So what you're talking about is a farm gate value of about $750 million right now for Afghan opium. We think it'll be closer to $900 million this coming year. And the subsidy for those farmers who are currently growing opium would be probably in the $500 million range that you'd have to do. You'd have to pay out cash subsidies of $500 million for people not to grow opium. That presents a couple of problems. First of all, where are you going to get the $500 million? It's tough. The whole counter-narcotics trust fund only has $70 million in it right now. But also, in the past, in Guatemala and even in Erzgan province, it was tried a couple of years ago, and people took the subsidy, and then they grew opium and sold it illegally anyway. So it didn't work, and we have no reason to suspect it would be any different if we offered those subsidies now. More importantly, only about 15% – let's keep in mind most Afghans are legal, law-abiding citizens. 85% of them are earning a legitimate living. Only 15% are involved in the illegal trade. If you start guaranteeing a huge high price for a crop to this 15%, what do you think everybody else is going to do? They're going to stop growing the legal livelihood to pay less money, and they're all going to jump into the opium trade. We've seen evidence of that in past opium battles in other countries as well. So we won't have 15% growing poppy. You'll have 30 or 40 or 50 or 80% growing poppy, and then the buyout cost goes from $500 million to $1 billion to $2 billion to $4 billion a year. And, you know, that's far more than the sum total of all money that's been spent in counter-narcotics throughout the entire battle over the past 5 years. So you'd have to have a massive, massive subsidy program, and assuming that people would sell to the legal market. The next problem with it is that if you did this and were willing to put the billions of dollars a year, you'd basically have a huge narco welfare state. That's all anybody would grow, and you'd have to do it ad nauseum for as far – there would be no reason to ever stop the program, so we'd have to be willing to be in it for 20 or 30 or 40 years. Instead of economic diversification, you would have economic unification of everybody growing one crop that we have to subsidize at the cost of billions of dollars per year. It would also cost many billions of dollars to build the infrastructure to process, manufacture, distribute, market this legal opium. None of that's there. Factories, marketing organizations, all of that which exists in Europe and in the United States are not there. So add another several billion dollars on to build that capacity. Then the capacity to prevent diversion would have to be built into it, a much stronger and forceful police force. In India, they recently, which is one of the places that produces legal opium, they recently reduced licit cultivation from 21,000 hectares per year to 8,000 hectares. Now, I'm realizing in Afghanistan you're talking about 165,000 hectares this year. They cut it from 21,000 to 8,000 because there was so much diversion to the illegal market that they couldn't control it. This is a well-developed democracy with a functioning police force, and they can't control it. What do you think would happen in Afghanistan? It's just not a viable option. And even if you went through all of that, which, you know, I think I've made my point, but you still have to sell it somewhere. And people talk about Africa, but right now the INCB, the International Narcotics Control Board, says there's no demand. There's a 30% oversupply of opium. So you have to create new markets where they don't exist, and you're talking many, many more billions of dollars there. So the idea of a legalization and buyout, I don't criticize anybody for having the idea. I don't criticize for anybody for looking for an easier solution than this very tough slogging process I've just laid out for you, but we just don't think it would work. We've studied it, we've looked into it, we've given it a fair hearing, and it just doesn't seem to hold water. So we've rejected that idea, and it's discussed in the paper extensively. Another one of the we call silver bullet theories, easy way out theories, is the miracle crop theory. I get more letters than you can imagine from people saying, if you just screwed Jatropha or this or that or 10 or 12 different crops, it would solve the problem. We've also studied that. And Afghanistan, as you know, has deserts, it has mountains, it has forests, it has everything. And there is no miracle crop. You have to tailor your plan to each individual province. And I'm very comfortable that AID is doing that. And we've never located any crop, any of them, that would even come close to equaling the income of poppy. I do get articles saying that certain ones do, but when we look into it, it doesn't work out. The closest thing we've found is fruit trees. And we are, you'll see in the paper, trying to divert some more resources into growing orchards and those types of things. But that takes time. You don't get fruit or nuts from an orchard until after a few years after it's planted. So we would need short-term holdover and type programs to handle that situation. So the miracle crop theory also we've looked into, and it, again, doesn't seem to hold water. We have to be very careful before we suggest that could work. Those are the two major ones we've got. Another one we do hear sometimes is stop putting money into eradication and focus only on interdiction. I think I've already sort of addressed that issue. Interdiction occurs after the farmer has been paid. The farmer will continue to grow poppy regardless of how many pounds or tons you interdict, because it doesn't affect them, and there will always be somebody to buy a lucrative crop. So, again, we feel there has to be a balanced approach. Shifting money away from eradication to interdiction we think is extremely wise, and we're not aware of anywhere where that has ever worked. So, again, the interdiction-only theory was something we studied very carefully. We did agree with one part of it, which is interdiction capacity has to be dramatically improved. 1 or 2% is not enough. We've got to get that number up higher. We have to interject significantly additional risk to the narco-trafficker, but doing it at the expense of eradication we think would be a catastrophic failure. I think that if we have some perseverance, if we have united political will in the United States, if we can work with our UK partners and our ISAF partners and the government of Afghanistan, and we all adopt the recommendations that are in this very, very well-considered interagency strategy paper, which, as I said, was I managed the effort, but it really was the product of experts and people who have been working at this for much, much longer than I have, for 20 and 30 years sometimes. I think that if we're united, if we don't allow the enemy to divide and conquer us by perpetuating myths and false information about what we're trying to do, I am absolutely convinced that this strategy will work. We already see it working in many provinces. The number of poppy-free provinces this year will grow dramatically. Big gains in the north. We have to sort of tighten the noose around the three big poppy-producing provinces in the south through that better coordination with security forces, through more aggressive eradication where alternatives are available, through better interdiction, through more effective means of alternative development, all of which we have some very specific proposals about. I think it'll work. I think it'll work soon, too. If we're united and if we execute on this plan, I think we'll start to see a turnaround in 12 to 24 months and can have the problem under control, hopefully, in 5 years. It won't be eliminated then. When I say problem under control, by the way, I don't mean no opium. There'll be opium there for a long time. But when I say the problem is under control, I mean it's under control to the point where it is no longer threatening the illicit economy. It is no longer a major source of income for the insurgents. And it is no longer a major corrupting influence on the government. Once we've achieved that level, I say we've had success, and that's what we're hoping for. So that's my summary, and I'm happy to take your questions. Thank you. Yes?
You want to? No, go ahead. No, that's fine. Just identify yourself, if you would, please.
Eric Malice from CSIS here.
Hi.
Thank you for that very thorough, very clear analysis. That was good. My question about the alternatives that you mentioned, given that you mentioned something about there not being an alternative crop, like a miracle crop that would quite do the same economically for the people as the opium, but at the same time, there are other alternatives that are being used that do work. I was curious, I just wanted some clarification there, and specifically, not only how the alternatives would help the farmers, but would also serve the traffickers that would have an economic interest otherwise to go against this sort of change. Mm-hmm. So much money from the illegal trade.
We think that the best way to get alternative development income up to as close as possible to poppy income is, first of all, to take the highest yield crops, like I said, fruit trees, for example, but also even for lower yield crops, if you have a good access to markets, it's amazing how much more money you can get. One thing when I was in Nangarhar a few months back, I went to a farm where they were growing lettuce, which in the local market wouldn't bring very much money. But what they were doing is they were taking that lettuce then over to a packing facility that was women-owned and run that was built by AID. And they were putting it in nice boxes and making it look real nice. And then they had an agent who was then selling that lettuce to the Serena Hotel in Kabul, to a couple of big hotels in Islamabad, and some in Dubai. And they were getting three or four times for that same crop what they could get just selling it locally. This is the kind of thing AID is advocating now, building a whole supply and distribution chain, which would involve not only farmers but local merchants and business people and also women, which was really important to us because the local shire had given permission for the women to own, operate, and run this entire thing, which brings a lot of additional income into the household. So what we're proposing is that type of a system, relying on not subsidizing crops, but subsidizing private sector development that gets goods and access to markets. That's the best way to get closest to the income from poppy, and that's the kind of proposals we'll be advocating.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Harlan Elmer here from CSIS. Thanks for your comments. Let me ask you two divergent questions. First, there are a number of people in this country who are very concerned that the drug pipeline can be used for other really nasty things. You don't have to necessarily smuggle only drugs or other things that come out. To what degree is that thinking at all affecting the broader national security context, what you're doing? And second, including the illicit sales, as we talked about earlier, I tend to think that Tobias Elwood, British MP, is a pretty good idea. And it's not for making the entire legalization throughout the country. It's looking at this as a step-by-step, using it in context with eradication so that you threaten, in essence, eradication, but you also provide a livelihood, even if you have to subsidize it, starting at home in the province. You talked about looking at all these silver bullets. Have you looked at these sort of hybrids where you don't necessarily have illicit sales throughout? Because the analysis I've seen, and I've read very carefully your critique that you put out in February of the Senlis report and so forth, and I think that there is a critique that can be made of your critique, but it seems to me that some combination on a step-by-step basis of testing this out, particularly in areas where there's a lot of Taliban, would seem to make sense even though it's going to be expensive.
Sure, sure. And with respect to the drug pipeline, we actually see more of the risks you're talking about in South America. You have situations now where drug traffickers are involved in human trafficking. They're involved in trafficking of weapons and other things. And so there's a real risk, and we coordinate very closely with the Department of Homeland Security because most of the drug issues we deal with are also other issues, immigration issues and terrorism issues and the like. So in Afghanistan, there are some incidents of cross-border type situations where drug traffickers are involved in other areas, but it's not as significant, we think, as the problem we have right in our own backyard, which is where we focus more on those issues. With respect to Tobias Elwood, I'm actually glad to hear you bring that up. Tobias Elwood's original proposal was more of a general legalization scheme. And he actually came and met with me, and I spent an hour and a half with him going over the same issues I raised here. And he sent me a letter with the proposal you just sent about 3 or 4 weeks ago, showing that he does recognize the value of a more balanced approach, eradication and other things, which we thought was progress. And he suggested a small-scale piloting type scheme, which is also what Senlis is now proposing. So we think we're making some progress. At least the idea of some vast legalization program has been ended. So we're studying that. I sent him a letter back with some questions about his proposal. The first thing that jumps to mind is one thing that we find consistently in Afghanistan is certain governors and people of certain provinces saying somebody else is getting special treatment. And what we're worried about with this piloting scheme right off the bat is perverse incentives. If you go down to Helmand and say, we're going to let you grow it legally, okay, and we're going to provide you these small subsidies and see how it works, then what we're going to have is the governor of Balkh and Badakhshan, where they've aggressively eliminated poppy and almost gotten rid of the problem, saying, wait a minute, should I start telling my people to grow it again because you're giving all this favoritism toward the people who are the criminals down in Helmand? And this is very common, not just in the drug area of Afghanistan, but in police training and all sorts of other areas where people claim we're not being equitable in how we're spending our money and the perks we're giving to certain people versus others. And it also relates to tribal issues where they think that we're favoring one tribe, we're favoring Pashtuns over Tajiks, that kind of a thing. So we're looking into it, but my initial reaction was it's an improvement. It shows a much more measured and studied effort to address the problem, but I haven't quite gotten over the idea of how you could show favoritism toward those who are the most aggressive drug growers and not create a perverse incentive among those who are not growing drugs. That's my problem. Sure, I'd like to. Thanks.
Yes, Arno.
had an off-the-record briefing yesterday by one of the agencies involved in what you've been talking about. They said there's corruption at every single level, and they really didn't know how to cope with it. It was just permeating absolutely everything. Is that true?
I don't know exactly what words to use to describe, and I'm going to be measured, but to deny there's significant corruption in Afghanistan would be wrong. There's very significant corruption. The question is, who is corrupt? Because of some of the rivalries I talked to you about, I mean, everybody says everybody is corrupt, and we know there are a lot of very honest people in Afghanistan, and what we're trying to do is sift through the data and figure out who's really corrupt and who isn't corrupt. And that's a much more difficult problem than people will give it credit for. I mean, everyone says, well, we know this person's corrupt or this person's involved. And I look at the information, and I get a lot of information that's not publicly available. And I was also a litigator and a prosecutor and a defense lawyer. And in many, many cases, you still don't have a case that could stand up in court against some of these people. That said, you have Attorney General Sabat, with whom I have regular meetings, have spent a lot of time with in Rome a couple weeks ago, and have spent time in his office in Afghanistan on a number of occasions. And he's the real deal in terms of wanting to root out corruption. He said he's launched a jihad against corruption, and that's what he's tried to do. Now, but he doesn't have, again, all the resources he needs to build cases he can prosecute. He's caught in the same bind I said that everybody is caught in, which is he might have a strong suspicion somebody is corrupt, but he still has to have the capacity to build a case. And so what we're trying to do now is help him out, and we're also working with Chief Justice Azimi, who has an anti-corruption organization now he's working with on a commission that's going to release a report soon, to try to give them the resources they need to prosecute high-level corruption cases. And there have been some. I mean, he's gotten a couple of high-level mayors and police chiefs, and there was a couple people recently that got 10 and 17 years respectively that were mid-level government officials. So we're working our way up to the high-level people. But it's easier said than done. Yes, there's a lot of corruption, but figuring out exactly who's corrupt and who isn't is difficult. And then once you're pretty sure who is, you've got to build the case. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to work very closely with the Attorney General because one thing we know is he's honest, and one thing we know is he's determined. Now he needs to be given the tools to really prosecute high-level cases. We're planning it on Tuesday, yeah.
And President Karzai will be here on December 5th and 6th, is that correct?
I'm not sure the exact dates, but soon after, yeah.
August.
Right. I'm not sure the exact dates. Right.
Has the government of Afghanistan or President Karzai signed off on this full plan, the five-point plan that you've mentioned?
Well, in both the cases of our UK counterparts and the government of Afghanistan, we coordinate everything we do with them. Our policies are not dictated by another government, so I got to be very careful. There's a phrase that's used now that I'm really getting sick of is socializing. Have you ever heard that? You socialize something with somebody. What that means now, it's like branding was a few years ago. It's a phrase everybody uses. What it means is you run it by somebody, you ask for their inputs, but you don't give them a veto power over it. And that's sort of what's been going on with this paper. It's, well, right, and nothing would be implemented. No, let me make something very clear. Nothing would be implemented without them saying yes. For example, the issue of ground-based sprays might be what you're getting at. We wouldn't go spray anything without the government of Afghanistan approving, but it doesn't mean we can't have a policy that says we need to look into this, and that's basically what we're doing.
So they will have a veto on the eradication plans as they are put into operation?
The government of Afghanistan is a sovereign government, and we don't do anything unless they say we can. There's been no direct discussions between the United States and the Iranians because we have to resolve some other issues before we do that. But the UNODC, Antonio Costa, has had trilateral meetings with the Pakistanis and the Iranians on these issues, and the UK has had some limited discussions with Iran on this, and the government of Afghanistan is very engaged with the Iranian government on the issue. Well, that's a possibility, but we'll have to look into it. I have to be measured in what I say here. That's I'm the ambassador for counter-narcotics and justice reform in Afghanistan, not for overall Iranian issues. We all know there's a commonality of interest between the U.S. and Iran on this issue. How that plays out in terms of discussions is something for other people to decide.
Let me just go back behind you, Harman.
I Those are very good questions, and I think that my point was that political will is an underestimated commodity. We're seeing in several provinces, which are not wealthy provinces, a strong, committed counter-narcotics effort can work. But you do have to give them, first of all, you have to give them the capacity to arrest and incarcerate, as we talked about. But most important, if they do achieve a poppy-free status, they have to see some sort of reward for that. And I think we've been lacking in that so far. And I think one of the initiatives you'll be seeing going forward is that if there is political will, it needs to be rewarded, and we will be doing that. The second part of your question about integrating it into the overall strategy for development of the entire country, definitely. When I talk about Helmand Province being the fifth largest recipient of U.S. aid of any country on earth, even though it's only a province, that involves direct assistance to poppy farmers, but it also involves building roads and dams and the dam up north. And definitely we recognize that any counter-narcotics strategy has to be an integrated part of an overall development strategy, and I think it is.
Marvin Blindbound, Middle East Institute. Rewards. 2 years ago, there was a project in Nangarhar, which in, I believe it was 2005, showed some considerable results, very much like the North, which, of course, is so minuscule that, whereas Nangarhar had it substantial. Nangarhar, after a couple of growing seasons, went right back. Apparently, a lot of small farmers got hurt. There was a great deal of concern here about the failure to deliver on the promises that had been made. Why not be willing, though, to see, and this goes back to the interim notion here. You've conflated, maybe it was just my confusion, the legalization with the subsidization or price intervention. Why can't some of that, put aside the legalization, but the price intervention, where they would return to their traditional crops, wheat and rice, introduce soybeans, which is just makes all kinds of sense. Nothing to do with incentives here, but simply given their diet, which are consumed mainly. Look, why not see this as a kind of stopgap until you can bring in the development contribution to this, until you can develop the court system and the jails in which you would incarcerate people, until you can develop a trust in government. What sets me a little bit here is that it sounds textbookish in that this is the formula. I know it's not a silver bullet, but it's got to be something where all of these parts are going to fall into place. As you say, it's going to be a slow process. But I think perhaps you're rejecting, especially with the subsidies, here. After all, look at the farm bill in front of us today. We've never given up on subsidies to farmers. We wrote the book on that. So we shouldn't feel, it's one thing about legalization of crops. Well, I'm going on too long, but I just see here that whether it's the veto that Karzai has and others, the power of these particular drug laws, because what we've done, as I think you were getting at, the success we've had has been to drive out the smaller traffickers, the smaller farmers, and now we've got a tougher job because the big guys are left and they're untouchable. So, sorry if I've been rambling here, but I just see that the idea that there's a plan and it's gonna work or can work, I think has to be modified by all of these other concerns.
Well, those are all good questions. Let me focus on the central point, which is subsidization, which was something we studied again very carefully and had a whole group and looked just at that question. In fact, Secretary Rice specifically asked us to look at that question of subsidization. And we agree that a form of subsidization is good, but direct cash subsidization
will never work.
Right.
It's for payment at the barn door.
Right, and you'll see. When I got to be kind of careful because I promise not to reveal the whole thing now. But the idea of subsidizing private industry to make sure crops get their highest price and are moved to market is something we're in favor of. The idea of cash subsidies is something we're against.
Back here.
Very good questions. We don't look upon it as two different issues. So we don't look upon it as diverting resources from counterinsurgency to go to counter-narcotics. If you have a situation where Taliban leaders and narco-traffickers are in direct alliance, they're really sort of fungible as far as we're concerned. But we do recognize that if we were to add an eradication or interdiction mission to ISAF, that would divert troops. So we're not asking for that, and it's not in their plan, and we don't want to. But what we do know is ISAF has a lot of intelligence about where narco-traffickers and Taliban are. We get some, too. It needs to be shared. That there's a possibility. Let me give you an example, and this is purely hypothetical, so I want to be very careful of the media here, not to suggest I'm suggesting this. But you had a situation last year where we had good information that there were a significant number of Pakistani and Afghan workers in Lashkar-Gah and in Kandahar City waiting to go out and harvest poppy. And we also had information that the price for labor was getting higher and higher. And this is a very good pressure point for poppy because it's a very labor-intensive product. And if you can increase the price of labor, all of a sudden the price for something illicit becomes more reasonable. They were worried about going out into the fields because they heard there were counterinsurgency operations going on out there. Well, this is an opportunity here. We would never target a laborer. We would never, you know, suggest in a million years that you target that. But it could have been a pretty good information campaign going out saying, look, you may be in these cities now, but we're not going to stop our counterinsurgency operations for you all to go out and harvest poppies. So if I were you, I wouldn't leave the city. You know, maybe that kind of a coordinated information campaign would have done two things, gotten less laborers out to the field and a much higher price for labor, which would have made poppy much less lucrative. So this is a very hypothetical example. But and because I'm restricted in what I can say about all the other intel we have, so I'm using a hypothetical example. But there are many, many examples where we see that if ISAF and the counter-narcotics forces were in direct communication – they might be to have very well-coordinated operations that wouldn't involve diverting person power to a counter-narcotics effort, but rather complementary efforts that would help both the counterinsurgency and the counter-narcotics efforts at the same time. And that's the kind of thing we're looking for, is that type of coordination.
Yeah. Sorry, Zoe Hudson, Open Society Institute. We do some grant-making inside Afghanistan. While we don't work on this issue inside the country, it's a dominant conversation on any visit. So my question is, you said that a significant percentage of farmers have been offered an alternative and had turned it down. And I'm wondering whether you have teased out what it looks like to be offered an alternative and how you quantify whether that's a real alternative. Because as you suggested, there's multiple components, right? You could help somebody grow a crop, but if there's no road or there's no market, then is that a complete package that they've turned down, or did they just turn down the seeds that year? And then along those same lines, the other common criticism we've heard is that people are being offered one-year programs, and for things like orchards, what they want is a multi-year commitment. They want to know for the next 5 years the U.S. government is investing in this new crop. And so are those the kind of things that you're looking at that will change in the coming years?
You sort of answered the question, but let me elaborate a little bit. When I say offered, I got to be very careful, by the way. It's a simple way of saying a more complicated idea. In some cases, we really didn't need to offer it. The alternative was already there. As I said, in Helmand Province, 75% of the cultivation is new in the past 2 years. So, you know, what were these people growing before? Obviously, they were growing something. It's not that they've been growing poppy for their whole lives and they need an alternative. They were growing something else and they switched to poppy. So, you know, when I say offer an alternative, I should say have an alternative. Some cases we offered it to them. Some cases they used to use the alternative and they've switched over to poppy. That's really the case in most of Helmand Province. But I want to be clear about how eradication is targeted. It's targeted based not just on is there another crop they can grow. It also includes access to markets, all those things. The UK has a very sophisticated targeting cell, which is not widely discussed, where before eradication can occur, they have to meet a whole series of criteria, which involves, and I say simply, they have an alternative. It's much more complicated than that. They have an alternative. They have access to markets. They have irrigation. They haven't been subject to drought. There's a whole series of things they go through so that you're really going after somebody who does have a viable means of another legal livelihood. Either it was offered to them and they turned it down, or they had it and they switched away to something else. And the problem we've had is when you have these negotiated eradication efforts, often the eradication forces switched away from the target area and into a non-target area, and that's where there's inequitable eradication. We acknowledge that's occurred. And what we're trying to do is be sure that we have the capacity not to negotiate, to stick where the targeting is so we know we're getting the right people.
In the world, if you
say somebody had an alternative, is that meaningful, right? Were they 2 years ago making a living? And did they now have the opportunity to feed their family, you know, for the first time, or get ahead for the first time, or put a roof on their
right.
house?
Well,
so it's a different context than just saying...
Yeah, well, let me make something very clear, and I'll be very direct about it. These people are growing poison that kills people, okay? I don't have a lot of sympathy for them, all right? If they can feed their family, we don't know of widespread starvation in Helmand province. We have never heard any report of that. It's a relatively wealthy province. I'm not saying they live like we do. I understand that. But they do have alternatives. They can feed their families. For most of them, there is a capacity to make a basic living, not something we might be happy with, but something that's acceptable in that society. But I don't have a lot of sympathy to the idea that, oh, we have nothing else to grow, so we're going to grow poison that kills people. I have no sympathy for that. Keep in mind what it is they're growing. They're growing heroin. They're not growing some nice crop that feeds their family. And it's illegal, and they know it's illegal. And so if there is a viable alternative, our position is they have to take it.
Yes, ma'am.
Ask you a little bit more about bringing this commitment. We work in the Helmand region, and one of the problems that we have with farmers and other people population is that they want to move to other alternatives, but it's a huge chance that they're taking, because if the political winds change and Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan is weakened or international assistance is gone, then they have to face the Taliban. So what kind of commitments are we doing, or what kind of sharing of information?
This is another excellent question. Every time I go to Afghanistan, people stop me and say, please don't leave. That's what they're worried about, that we'll give up on our commitment. And I think that it's important for ISAF to get that message too, because I think the U.S. government is very committed to Afghanistan. And I think most of our allies are too. But every now and then you hear about wavering countries, and I think that makes them very, very nervous. So you're right about that. It's important for us to show we have the political will to stick it out. Now, in the south of Afghanistan, I heard a senior British general once say that it's very interesting in the dynamic down there. You have only about 10 or 15% that are really hardcore in favor of the Taliban, but you only have about 20 or 25% that are really very much in favor of the government, and all the rest are waiting to see who wins. So my answer is we got to show them we're going to win. You know, we got to be tough on the narcotics trade at all levels and tough on the insurgency at all levels. Say, if you side with them, you're on the losing side. I mean, that's my response to it. Yeah, we estimate, though, that that's about a third in the south and very little in the north. So that's an issue we have to deal with, and one of the things we'll talk about, again, I'm supposed to walk this tightrope about telling you some but not everything, but the idea of extending credit and protection is very, very important, and you're right about that, and that will be part of our upcoming rollout. Credit particularly, which USAID is developing much bigger credit programs, so they can also lend money to farmers, microcredit, very important piece, you're right.
Clarify something for me. You said a moment ago that you seem fairly vague about what land use might have been going on in the past. Does this indicate that interagency cooperation is not being particularly effective? There is an absolute wealth of remote sensing data at sufficient.
It's happening a lot, and I've talked. The UK does most of it. David Mansfield does it on the ground. They've got satellite imagery studying all this. You know, I'm just sort of simplifying for the purpose of the group. But what I'm saying is, they weren't growing it 2 years ago. They were either it was fallow land, which we know in some cases was wasn't being grown at all, or they were switching crops. Yeah, and we know that definitely. In a lot of cases, it was land that wasn't under cultivation at all that's now being brought under cultivation for opium. But the UK has done a remarkable job of mapping all that out for us. And that's, you know, we put a lot more money into it, the United States does, and we have a lot of people on the ground, and we rely very much on our UK counterparts for intelligence and information, and we have a really good division of labor. And, you know, my UK counterpart's named Peter Holland. I love him. A number of you probably run into him. I'm on the phone with him on a daily basis. I email him all the time. We send information, both classified and unclassified, back and forth to one another. I think it's actually a very well-functioning alliance between the U.S. and the U.K. on that. And they do most of the intelligence work.
Harlan, do you want to come back?
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question in your capacity as a litigator. It wasn't too long ago that prosecutors in Kabul were only getting 60 euros a month, and that reforms in the legal and judicial system were really failing, and I believe they still are. Could you comment on both, and what, if anything, can be done to spur the Italians and the Germans?
You know, you are going to leave me with nothing left to say on Tuesday, okay? You're absolutely right. And you have a situation where prosecutors are paid less than police. And if you talk to Dr. Sabat, he says, look, why do you think they take bribes? Because they're making less than a police officer. So increasing pay is a critical part of it. You might have read about the Rome conference that occurred about 3 weeks ago. I was one of the U.S. representatives there. And it was a big success. It came up with about $100 million of new money for the justice sector. And it also agreed to establish a trust fund for salaries for judicial people. So it's exactly what you're saying. It hasn't been put into place yet, but everybody recognized the problem. And if you're not giving somebody a living wage, they're going to be more susceptible to bribery. So we have addressed that issue. The money isn't there yet, but we think it'll be there soon. Yeah, well, that's what the purpose of the Rome conference was. President Karzai and the Secretary General of the United Nations were there, so everyone recognized how important this was. We instituted, for example, the United States had approved a provincial justice mechanism. You might have read about this because there's such spotty justice in the provinces. UNAMA is going to administer it. We're going to get advisors out in the field to assess what's there and what isn't, where money ought to be put, where it shouldn't be put, where there's overlaps, where there's gaps. And there's going to be a national justice program adopted, we think, in October in Kabul that will put all these pieces together of what's missing, where the money is needed, and how it ought to be put together. It's a long time coming. It's like, you know, you can't have two-thirds of a democracy. And a lot of work was put on executive and legislative part of the country, but almost nothing on the judicial part. And finally, people have come around to recognizing that that's important. And that's one of the reasons that when I was given this new position in March, it was also for justice reform. We recognized that we needed somebody who was really focusing on that issue. And we have a rule of law coordinator now in Kabul also, who's my counterpart, who works on the ground out there. So you're absolutely right. It has been lagging way behind. There's so many things to be done in Afghanistan. It's inevitable that something falls behind. But I think with the kind of attention that was and the spotlight that was put on it in Rome, that was backed up by real money and specific things that were adopted, it wasn't just a talk fest. A lot of these international things are just a big talk fest. There were concrete deliverables that I think will improve the delivery of justice. And I think in October, when they release the new National Justice Program, you'll see. I mean, literally, the Attorney General's Office and the Supreme Court and the Ministry of Justice came up with specific lists of what they need, not general things like we need help. We need this many vehicles, this many trainers, this kind of a facility in these provinces, and they listed them in priority and how much it would cost. And now donors are going to stop and check off which one they're going to do. So I think it's going to be a much more organized effort going forward.
Are there any other questions? Yes.
Integrated is a difficult word when you have that many countries in a country. You know, you have all these provinces and 30, was it, I can't remember if it's 26 or 37 ISAF nations there now. I think it's 37. So what we do is we do our best. I was in Canada the week before last. I've been to 15 European capitals in the past 12 months to talk to them about our approaches and make sure we're coordinated. And I've also briefed the NAC, the NATO, all of them together, all the ambassadors in Brussels, and had numerous meetings with the EU Council. And they had a delegation visiting me yesterday. So it's difficult. I have to say, when you have that many countries that are trying to help another country, staying fully coordinated, I'm not going to say it's seamless, but we do our best.
The last question. Yes.
Yeah, good questions. Both the U.S. and the U.K., and I don't ever speak too much for another government, so I'll limit it, agree that there needs to be more effective eradication. Both agree eradication is an essential part and more effective. The means of delivery is still under discussion, and that's about as much as I'll say.
Well, thank you all very much for your good questions and comments, and please join me in thanking Tom for being here.